Well, it's a time to get started here. All right, so we're just recently, for the visitors, just recently started a series on the miracles of Jesus. And so we did the birth of Christ on Wednesday. Today we're going to be doing the turning of the water into wine in the wedding feast at Cana. So if you'd like to turn over to John chapter 2. And we'll be focusing mostly in this, right here in this section this morning. So John chapter 2, starting in verse 1. Says, on the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. The master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. So this, as is stated, is the first miracle that Jesus himself actually performed. And I think it's going to be an important part of that to show who Jesus is. This is the beginning of him actually revealing himself, though in a limited way. So let's go ahead and begin from the beginning of this passage and start looking at some more of the details. It says, on the third day. The third day from what?
The Sabbath day would have been the Sabbath. So I'm supposing it would have been maybe the third day from the Sabbath, which would be our
day. Okay. I hadn't thought about it in that way.
Well, John was mentioning days as he goes along in this narrative. He said the first day, this happened, and the second day, this happened. Now he says on the third day, I think is what he's saying.
Yeah. Okay. I agree. I think that's what's going on here. So in John 1, and let's see where it is. So we got the events that take place in verses 19 through 28. Then verse 29 says, the next day, he, that is John, saw Jesus coming towards him. 35, it says, the next day. Verse 43, it says, the next day. So, is the third day from John 19 through 28? Or 1, 19 through 28? Or is it the third day from the day mentioned in verse 43?
That I can't.
Okay. I think we actually can make a logical conclusion to that, is that it would be the third day from the day mentioned in verse 43. And the reason I say that is because it doesn't mention until verse 43 that he decided to go to Galilee. And previously, where was he at?
Capernaum.
Look at verse 28 in chapter 1.
Bethany.
Bethany, yes. He was in Bethany across the Jordan. Does anybody know roughly where that was at? I wish I had prepared a map to put it up there. I think there is some...
Wasn't that kind of near where the children of Israel crossed the Jordan?
Yeah, I think it would be somewhere near there. Yeah, it was pretty much straight to the east of Jerusalem, or close to that, but just across the Jordan. Where, then, was Cana? Yeah, it's up in the region of Galilee. It's near Nazareth. Does anybody know how near Nazareth? Because we'll bring this up too. No, it's actually only about 4 miles away from Nazareth. And as depending on how accurate the locations are of where people estimate that Bethany beyond the Jordan was and Cana, just doing a quick measurement with Google Earth, as the crow flies, is about 64 miles. So if he decided to go on the day in verse 43, it'd be kind of hard. And if this was the third day from the original day mentioned in John, it would be traveling 64 miles in one day. And they were walking. Good luck doing that. So, I believe we can say that it actually is the third day from the day when he actually called Philip and Nathanael. All right. So, why would Jesus' mother have been present at this wedding? Yeah, I think that's probably a good guess. Do we have any idea why this is giving me feedback on this microphone, Ken? I don't know. Maybe it's the tie. I don't know. Apparently not. It's a little annoying. Okay. We'll move on anyway, and if I need to, I'll switch microphones. So I agree that it could very well have been family. If not, it was probably close friends, because I mean, there's other reasons to make guesses at that. So it mentions that Jesus was invited to the wedding with his disciples. Who would have been with him at this time? Which of the disciples?
That's pointing toward the speaker, Zach, so that's probably going to be a little worse feedback.
We'll try various things. Maybe we'll get it working.
Possibly Philip and Nathaniel and John and Peter and
Andrew.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's probably correct there. Does anybody know what a wedding feast would have been like in those days under that culture?
It's usually about 7 days long is what I've read.
Yeah. I read 5 to 7 days.
It's usually someday. In the fall after the crops are ready.
Okay. Yeah. I did read that as well. I have no idea how consistent that was, but I did read something about that. Who all would have been invited to a wedding in those days? Does anybody know that?
My relatives.
Yeah.
All of the people in the community were some of them.
Yeah, I did read that it was, and often the entire village was invited. Fact, I should probably just find my notes on that part here. Yeah. And I don't know what day of this wedding feast this would be, because as Dave mentioned, it was often 7 days long, sometimes five. I did see something that said possibly even longer than 7 days in some cases. But from what I read, it would begin in the evening, and as the Jews count days, that would be the start of a day. When the bridegroom with his friends would go to the bride's father's house and fetch the bride, essentially, and bring her back in procession. And she would be carried on a litter. And they would bring her back to the bridegroom's house. And one of the friends of the bridegroom would be the master of the ceremonies or the master of the feast.
A lot of people, because if they drunk all that wine beforehand,
yes,
there'd be a lot of people.
We have no idea really how much wine they had to begin with, but it would have been a lot of people probably. And it also depends on how big the community was too. So it's kind of hard to know how many people, but we can guess it was a good number. So after they bring, or on the way to the bridegroom's house, they would be singing wedding songs, and then a blessing would be bestowed on the couple by the groom's parents. Prayers would be offered, and then throughout the evening, they would pass the time in games and dancing. But the bride and her friends and companions would actually withdraw to another room. And the bridegroom would participate in the festivities. Then the next day was, I was getting a little bit confused as to when the actual feast was. Because the thing I was reading, it seemed kind of disjointed in how they were laying things out. So they would be basically just almost a holiday on the first day of the feast. And they would be giving gifts, singing songs, and then late in the day they would serve a meal. And at this point, the men and women were segregated. And then in the evening would be when the groom would arrive. And that after the groom arrived, that's when everybody would get together. And then the actual feast would begin, was my understanding of it. So it could be around this time, I don't know. It could be later, because though they would have blessings imparted on them by perhaps the leaders of the synagogue or whatever that evening, during the feast, or just before the feast, as I said, I couldn't figure out what was going on exactly what time frame. That first evening, the couple would leave, consummate the marriage, and then they had actually come back and participate in the wedding feast for the rest of the time, rather than our tradition of going on a honeymoon. And that would just continue for several days. So that's just kind of the gist of what's going on. We have no idea, as far as I can tell, we have no way of knowing how many days this feast had been going on when they ran out of wine. But it does bring up a curious question of why would Mary be concerned? It wasn't her family. It wasn't her wedding feast. It wasn't anything to do with her or Jesus directly. So why would she be concerned over the lack of wine? Or more particularly, why would she actually be seeking to do something about it?
Well, if they were relatives, you know, there would certainly be an interest in wanting to help.
Yeah.
You know, who knows, she might have, you never know, you know, weddings these days, you know, family members are oftentimes involved in the planning and carrying out of the wedding and festivities and things.
So, I think this is another evidence to say that it is at least a close friend, if not actually a relative, because she seemed to have actually had some hand in helping to take care of things and organize things. Let's see. And especially the fact that the servants obeyed her without questioning seems to imply that she had some level of authority in their eyes. So, why is it that she would actually bring this problem to Jesus?
She knew he had authority.
Okay, she had confidence in him, she knew he had authority. Was she requesting a miracle? That's what a lot of people think. But was she?
Well, she knew Jesus was a miraculous child.
Yes.
She knew that he did that.
He was, yeah. She knew who Jesus would be when he was born.
But
he'd never actually done a miracle at this point.
But the way Jesus answers, almost acts, it makes it appear that what she's asking for is something she shouldn't be asking for. Mm.
Yeah, but what is she asking for?
Something she shouldn't be asking for.
She's asking for more wives.
Actually, what I find interesting is she doesn't actually even ask.
It's a statement.
Yeah, it's a statement.
Typical woman, she doesn't have to think.
She's a mother.
I think that is actually a very good point on this. Because it seems to me it's not that she's asking for a miracle, because Jesus hadn't done a miracle at this point. What seems more likely to me is that because she is in at some level of authority here, I know I've had it happen. How many grown sons, when they're at something, or whether it be at home and your mother is hosting people, or whether you're at an event where your mother is hosting something, how many times does she end up going and delegating authority to get something done to you? It's like, okay, there's this problem. I need somebody to handle it because I'm busy. Jesus, they have no wine. And then she gives the servants, okay, go ahead.
Jesus was her firstborn.
Yes.
So.
And he was probably 30 or 33, I guess, somewhere in that realm, anyway, by this point.
And his father seems to be out of the picture by this time.
Yes. There's no mention of Joseph around. So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense that it would just be she has a problem, she needs it fixed. She goes to her eldest son, who is a man and responsible. There's also a possibility that because Jesus by this time, even from Luke chapter 2 when he was 12 years old, had surprised people by his wisdom and his understanding. So she may also have just come to him because she expects him to come up with a wise solution to the problem. And I don't think there's any reason to think that she was expecting a miracle, because he had, by this point, not really given anybody any reason to expect him to do miracles. He just was known to be very wise.
His younger brothers and his disciples were there, so even if he didn't perform a miracle, between all of them, they could have accomplished something.
Yeah, yeah. And then she also tells the servants to do whatever he tells you. So she could have been expecting him to go buy some more wine. and would in the quantities that they might need, he would need help bringing it back. So that's why she gave him authority to command the servants to help him. I think that makes a lot of sense. I can't say it absolutely that that is the case, but it makes more sense to me than her asking for a miracle at this stage. So
his response was, "His hour has not yet come."
Yes, we'll get to that. So why is it that Mary assumes Jesus will take care of the issue, even though he didn't actually say that he would?
Because he was an obedient child. She needed okay. to do the right thing.
I think that's part of it.
Jesus would be in charge of it, in charge of the disciples that were with him, and she expected him to do something about that, and go get it and bring it in or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Did Jesus actually say no? Or was his answer a denial?
You are allowed to answer your own question then.
Well, of course, he presents the statement as though it's not his problem in a way. It's just what yeah. you're concerned have to do with me. In other words, I'm not part of the directing committee on this wedding feast, so why are you coming to me?
Yeah. But is that a denial?
No, it's not a denial. He's making a statement like she made a statement. We have no wine. Mm-hmm.
I think the easiest answer to why we can say it was not a denial is because she then turns to the servants and said, "Do whatever he tells you." She apparently took it as some form of acquiescence. So why does Jesus, in his response here, referred to his mother as woman? Doesn't that seem kind of rude or terse, the way it's stated here?
Well, I imagine that's a different culture and things mm-hmm. meant different, terminology were used differently.
Yeah. And from what I read, the word used here, even though it gets translated as woman in English, is actually more of a formal term. So it'd be more similar to our saying lady or ma'am or something of that nature. So it's not, even though in English it comes across as being kind of rude in some ways, especially to somebody as close as your mother, it probably was not actually that in that culture and in Greek or Hebrew. So, let's see. Actually, had my brother point out one interesting thing is if you look over at Luke chapter 12 and verse 14, there's a similar sentence structure over here. And it could be this. I didn't get to look into it deeply, but it could be the same sort of thing going on. So, starting verse 13, it says, "Someone in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me.' But he said to him, 'Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?'" It's a very similar type of thing. And I don't know that it's there either a rude response. It's just, and it could be translated as, "Sir, or something of that nature that's a little bit more formal. And again, kind of, what does this have to do with me? Is
if he had addressed her as mother or ma'am or something, would that have, in a sense, given her authority over what he was about to do? Like if your mother asked you, in the scenario that you said earlier, if she asked you to do something, you'd get a yes ma'am or yes mother or something, mm-hmm. said acquiescing to her authority, essentially. And it wasn't by her authority that he performed that miracle.
But she didn't ask for a miracle anyway.
No, she
left him free to choose whatever method he wanted to do to solve the problem. She just delegated the problem to his.
Jesus did say my hour has not come yet, so that mm-hmm. to me kind of implies he did something that he was going to be revealed.
Okay.
He wasn't ready for that.
Yeah. So what hour is he referring to?
Probably the beginning of his sort of public ministry where he was revealing himself as the Messiah and more.
Okay, so basically he did do that because it mentions that he manifested his glory and his disciples believed in him in verse 11. So since he had his hour has not come, is that the correct answer?
Well, it's possible that his hour had not come yet, but because his mother requested of him to do this thing, that he did it.
No, he didn't make a show of doing this.
Yes.
He never drew attention or made a big announcement to everybody, hey, we're out of wine. Watch me. Let me show you what I'm going to do. He did this very concealed. So
yes.
Really, the only people who saw what he was doing were the ones he wanted to see, mainly the disciples that he had just recruited.
Mm-hmm.
If you put yourself in their position, you have just been called by Jesus to be a disciple, to be one of his followers. You're sitting there with him and very nonchalantly, shall we say, without any fanfare, he does this miracle. Water into wine. Now, very simplistic thing, but if you're sitting there, it's going to get your attention.
Yes.
And I'm sure it did too.
Yes. Very good. So, I completely agree. He didn't. And I don't think the hour was referring to the beginning of his ministry, because his statement of my hour has not yet come is a recurring theme in John, or referring to my hour is a recurring theme. If you look over at John, or we got here, we've got John 7 verse 30 and John 8 verse 20, at all three of those locations, he says, my hour has not yet come, or something very similar. So what, if we're looking at that as a recurring theme, when is it that he actually, does anybody know offhand, when it is that he actually starts saying that his hour had come?
In the garden, I think, when he was about to be arrested, that's when he said that, I believe.
Okay. It's a little bit earlier than that.
When he was in the upper room, he talked about
yes.
this hour.
Yeah,
yeah, it's John 12 is when it. John 12, 23, verse 27, and then chapter 13, verse 1, and 17, verse 1 are all the locations where he says, my hour has come. In which case, what is the hour he's referring to?
The trial, the arrest, the crucifixion.
Yeah. It's not so much a literal hour as the coming to the end of his life and the crucifixion and trials and all that's leading up to that. So I agree with Gary that what's going on here is he's saying my hour has not yet come. It's not time to make himself known. And so he does a literally hands-off miracle that's and doesn't let many people know what's going on. And so what are these, and these six stone water jars are here for the Jewish rites of purification. What are those, what is that referring to? What are the rites of purification? Yeah. And so how much do all of these together hold? How much wine is it or and that Jesus well, actually
120
makes?
120 gallon or 180 gallon.
Yeah. Yeah, each held 20 to 30 gallons, so it's somewhere in that realm. Somewhere between 120 and 180 gallons that he made. And what then also would be the role of the master of the feast? What is his, who is he, what is he doing?
He seems to be, in this case at least, sort of the taster.
Okay. Okay, yeah.
Like, you know, back in the day, the kings had someone who, I guess, maybe traditionally asked the food to see if it was the best, you know, to give to the king or to the bridegroom.
Okay. I, from what I've read, he's probably similar to, or his role is probably similar to that of a butler or the head caterer. And one source that,
I said wedding planner.
Possibly, yes.
It would be a feast planner.
Yeah. And one source I read that he is basically charged with seeing the food and drink is distributed and that Jewish laws and customs were maintained, which would include, like, proper mixing of the water and wine to reconstitute it, nobody drinking too much, that kind of thing. So what would be meant in that culture by good wine and porter wine?
Didn't taste as good.
Didn't taste as good.
Could it be the age?
The age, yeah. I think that's a factor in there.
The bad wine may have had more water content.
Okay, if yeah, it could be that the porter wine was more watered down.
And as the natural fermentation process goes on, the more sour something begins because all the organisms feed off the sugar, so mm-hmm. naturally it becomes more sour.
Okay. So, this is a question I cannot answer because I don't have experience with. Does a higher alcohol content make wine taste better? I don't know the answer. I've heard, and basically from what I've been told, no, it doesn't. And some will try to argue that the good wine must have been a stronger drink, a higher alcohol content, but that doesn't really make any sense. So in a culture that had no refrigeration, what would be the more valuable? Would it be fermented juice, wine as we refer to wine, or would it be fresh grape juice? Because fresh grape juice does not keep well in hot weather. And the word that is actually used here, in spite of it being translated wine, refers to anything that is made from grapes. Or any drink, at least. It may even include more than that, but basically anything made from grapes. And the translators translate it as wine. But we basically, because of that vagueness of the word, have to base it on the context. Is it alcoholic or not? And to what degree or anything of that nature?
Well, and naturally, the longer anything sits out, the higher the possibility of being contaminated with other organisms, other yeast, wild yeast, whatever. So the longer it sits out, the more sour it's going to become, the more off flavors it's going to have. So yeah, this is some bad stuff here. Mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a higher alcohol content, depending on what type of yeast or bacteria is infiltrated into it.
So why would the good wine be offered before the poor wine?
Well, if it has alcohol content, that would explain some of that, because somebody who gets a little tipsy is not going to necessarily notice.
Okay.
You know, then when the bad wine comes up.
That's a possibility.
I'd say you always put your best face forward, so.
Yeah.
Bring out the good stuff first.
So what does the master of the feast say about it? When is it that they bring out the poor wine?
Do they have too much to drink?
When they ran out of the other.
When they ran out of the other. I don't know that it's necessarily when they had too much to drink. Because Jewish culture, as well as Christian teachings, are condemnatory of drunkenness. And so I don't think there's any reason to say that they were drunk. It says when they have drunk freely. I think some other ways of translating that would also be when they are satisfied. So when they've had enough that they're content is when they would make the transition from the good wine to the poor wine, because then they don't care as much. They've already been satisfied. That's not to say, I cannot say one way or the other if there was any alcohol content or not. I have my own opinion on that, but I can't actually say definitively one way or the other. So does it make sense, or what makes more sense with the wine that Jesus produced here? Would it have been grape juice, or would it have been wine, based on Jesus' own teachings, as well as what we know from the New Testament about what Scripture says about drinking, as well as what the Old Testament says about drinking? Which makes more sense to you? Yeah. It'd be more unusual to have fresh grape juice because it's so hard to keep it. And so it would be that much more valued and taste that much better when you only get it when the grapes are fresh, right off the vine, and then they press them. And basically, any time outside of that period of time, they had methods of saving grape juice and trying, I don't know, they could boil it down and concentrate it, basically, or store it in caves or something to try and essentially refrigerate it to some degree, or things of that nature. So it's not that they didn't have ways of having non-alcoholic wine. But they also wouldn't adjust the flavor, basically. So the fresh stuff would still be the best tasting. So what is it that Jesus did here? As Rick had pointed out in his introduction, What does this say about who Jesus is?
He's capable of changing materials from one thing to another. Mm-hmm. You know, grape juice and water, two very different things.
Yeah. Is there any way that he could have tricked people in this case? I don't think so, because even if you wanted to say that they were to use a concentrated thing and try and mix up some wine, which is a lot of the cases where the Bible mentions mixed wine, it's either mentioning mixing herbs and stuff into it, or it's meant or referring to actually taking a concentrated juice and reconstituting it, so you're mixing it with water. We are out of time. Because I'll just make this point real quick. One of the things that he had the servants do was they filled the stone jars to the brim. There was no room to add anything else in there. And then when he actually changed it into wine, if you start thinking about what that would actually involve, whether it's alcoholic or not, I just for the fun of it, I went and looked up the contents or all the or what the compounds and stuff that are in grape juice are. And there are at least 23 different ingredients, water being the majority of it, but including like acids and sugars and let's see, nitrogenous compounds and minerals. And you think about, okay, he in an instant turned 120 to 180 gallons of water that had been used for purification, so it wasn't even pure water necessarily, into fresh grape juice or wine, whichever way you think it might be, in the right proportions to make it the best. In an instant. It's pretty fascinating. So, thank you for the attention and your good comments.